I spent all day Wednesday riding through the countryside around the place where we had pulled that first holdup. That confirmed what I already thought. There wasn't a better spot to board and stop the train. But that didn't mean we'd do things exactly the same way this time. I thought as I rode back east through that series of ridges to a spot a couple miles away, where the terrain dropped off fairly steeply to a broad flat. I reined in and sat there for a couple of minutes while a grin spread slowly over my face. The next day, we all gathered at the fish hook again to go over the plan I'd hatched. We all talked it out, up one way and down the other. And when the time came, we'd all know what to do. It seemed to be Friday afternoon in the blink of an eye, and suddenly there I was again, stretched out on top of that ridge the same way I'd been several months earlier, waiting for the train to rumble past my location. I waited, and I waited for the train to get there, and it seemed that it never would. Finally, the locomotive drew even with my position, and then passed me. I wasn't alone this time. I looked over at Santiago and nodded. We would do this together. As I came up on my feet, Santiago did likewise. He had never done anything like this before, but he didn't hesitate even for a second. He sailed off the top of that cut bank right along with me. I landed on top of one freight car, and he landed on the car right behind it. I grabbed hold and steadied myself, turning my head as I did so to make sure he had landed safely. He was spread-eagled in the center of the next freight car's roof, holding on for dear life. But after a moment, he lifted his head and gave me a nod to let me know he was all right. I waved at him and got to my hands and knees. Then I climbed to my feet, keeping my legs wide apart to brace myself. I looked over my shoulder and saw that Santiago had made it to his feet, too. We started toward our respective destinations, me going toward the engine while he headed for the caboose. It took me only a couple of minutes to reach the coal tender and start working my way along the ledge to the side of it. I was making better time now than I had during the previous one. The locomotive was just emerging from the cut when I swung around into the cab and covered the engineer and fireman with my Remington.
Hands up, boys. You're making an unscheduled stop.
Funny thing, they didn't seem particularly surprised by my sudden appearance. And that was the first thing that set off warning bells in my head.
Stop the train now!
The engineer reached for the brake lever without even arguing. The train began to slow. It came to a stop about 50 yards short of the wash where the rest of the boys had waited last time. They weren't there today. That was the first difference in the plan. I kept the engineer and fireman covered as I leaned back to look along the right side of the train toward the caboose. I spotted Santiago standing beside the express car. He snatched off his hat and waved it at me to let me know that his part of the plan had been completed successfully. Fireman lunged at me. I twisted aside from his rush.
Zeke, no! You're not...
I walloped him on the back of the head with my gun. He pitched out of the cab and landed sprawling on the edge of the roadbed, rolling over a couple times before he came to a stop. I pointed the Remington at the engineer's face.
Reverse! Now!
The engineer gaped at me.
Reverse!
The engine still had enough steam up for what I had in mind. The engineer started backing the train along the tracks. It gradually built up speed. The line ran pretty straight through the ridges. The train was going only about half as fast in reverse as it had been going forward. But that was fast enough for our purposes. I kept one eye on the landmarks sliding past until we were in the right spot.
Stop!
Instinctively, the engineer hauled back on the brake lever. With a violent lurch, the train began to slow again. Since it wasn't going as fast, it didn't take as long for it to stop this time.
Turn around.
Please, mister, don't kill me. I got a wife and kids.
I will kill you if you don't turn around.
With his hands in the air and a terrified expression on his face, the engineer swung around so his back was to me. I reversed the Remington and tapped him on the back of the head with the butt. Hard enough to knock him out for a few minutes without doing any real damage. Then I leapt down from the cab. Enoch loomed up, coming in from the west leading my horse. I swung into the saddle. My mount never even slowed to a complete stop before I was on its back, finding the other stirrup and leaning forward over the horse's neck. Along the tracks to the east, I could see the express car and caboose still rolling freely on the steel rails. Santiago had uncoupled them from the rest of the train after taking over the caboose and knocking out the conductor. Those two cars had been pushed along with the rest of the train while the locomotive was backing up. But once the locomotive stopped, they kept going. The cars were almost at the top of the slope, and as Enoch and I galloped after them, I saw them speed up even more as gravity caught them and started pulling them down the hill. As we started to ride past the passenger cars, the glass in the windows exploded outward. A Gatling gun. It was a trap. Pistol bullets also smashed the windows in the passenger car and clawed through the air at me and Enoch.
Stay down!
I was practically laying down on my horse's neck. I felt the heat of several rounds passing close to my head. Then the horse lurched and went down. I kicked my feet free of the stirrups and slammed to the ground. Enoch leaned down from the saddle and extended a hand toward me. His hand slapped against mine and we grabbed wrists. I came off the ground, Enoch hauling me upward. I kicked my leg upward and got my foot over the back of the horse, hooking it against the far side of the saddle. I pulled myself up even more and settled down on the horse's back behind Enoch. For the last few seconds, I'd been so concerned with not falling and getting trampled, I hadn't had a chance to notice we made it past the car where the Gatling gun was set up. That didn't mean we were out of the woods, though. Slugs still whipped through the air all around us. It's mighty hard to hit a fast-moving target, though, even up close. We were stretching our luck mighty thin, though, and abruptly, it ran out. I felt a bullet slash across my upper right arm at an angle.
You hit?
Just keep going!
Enoch did, making that horse flash along the train. Even though the animal was carrying double, Enoch got every possible ounce of speed out of him. The bullet wound numbed my arm at first, but that only lasted a few seconds before it started burning like hell. I gritted my teeth against the pain and hung on. The passenger cars were behind us now. The train sat there on the tracks behind us. I glanced back and saw riflemen jumping out of the cars. As soon as they landed, they started firing at us again. Enoch juked that horse back and forth, though, and the slugs whizzed around us but didn't find their targets. We reached the top of the slope and plunged over it. That risked the horse falling as we began to descend at breakneck speed toward the flats below. But thankfully, that critter was sure-footed and stayed upright, even though he slid a little every now and then. The express car and the caboose still rolled along the flats, although they were beginning to slow down now that they were back on level ground. I spotted Santiago leaning out from the platform at the rear of the caboose. Off to the left, dust boiled up as the rest of the boys galloped to intercept the two cars. One of the Gallardo brothers led Santiago's horse. I was willing to bet that the express car held more armed men and no gold bullet.
Wave off the others! Let them know it's a trap!
Enoch pulled his Colt from its holster and fired three times in the air to get the others' attention. Then he pouched the iron and jerked his hat off. He started waving it, motioned for him to stay away from the train. The boys immediately split up and veered sharply away from the railroad tracks, scattering in different directions so pursuers would have a harder time tracking them. Except for Javier or Fernando, whichever brother it was leading Santiago's horse, he kept going. He wasn't gonna abandon his cousin. Santiago leapt down from the platform and ran to meet the rider. After a few more steps, he slowed, half-turned, and threw some shots back at the express car, just to discourage any guards who might be in there, I figured. The Gallardo brother reached him, and Santiago leapt into the saddle. They turned and galloped away. By now, Enoch and I were almost to the bottom of the slope. He angled his horse away from the tracks, too. There was no rendezvous point this time. In the event of trouble, we were all supposed to ride far and wide, away from each other, and eventually make our way back to the fishhook. Instinct made me look behind us again. I bit back a curse as I saw a cloud of dust rising in the air from the place where the train was stopped. That meant a lot of riders.
There's already a posse on our trail.
How can that be?
Well, they probably had horses hidden in the boxcars. Law dogs pulled that trick on me before.
I tapped Enoch on the left shoulder and pointed.
Head for those rocks over there.
We're gonna make a stand.
Not you. I am.
The hell with that. We'll get away together or we'll die together.
This horse can't outrun a posse carrying both of us. Damn it, Enoch.
You got a gal to go back to. I don't.
But you got friends.
It ain't the same thing, and you know it. You take the horse, and I'll ford up in the rocks and slow the bastards down.
We were almost there. I saw movement behind the boulders. For a second, I thought it was another trap, until a rider spurred out in the open, and I recognized Randy. Enoch reined in.
Damn it! You were supposed to get out of here. It was all a trick, and now there's a posse after us.
We figured that out. I saw the two of you riding double and knew you must have lost your horse, Mr. Strickland. That's why I came back. You can have mine.
No way in hell I'm leaving you here. Either of you.
You don't have to. I weigh quite a bit less than you, Mr. Strickland. Enoch's horse can carry him and me.
All right. Let's swap, and we'll all get out of here.
I swung up on Randy's horse, ignoring the pain from my bullet-creased arm.
Go! I'll be right behind you.
Enoch heeled his horse into a gallop again. I burst out from behind the rocks and raced back toward the posse, which was now riding down the hill in the direction of the flats. They were still several hundred yards away from me, so to be sure they didn't fail to see me, I pulled Randy's rifle from the saddle boot and cracked off several rounds in the posse's general direction. After firing these shots, I swung due east, galloping parallel to the railroad tracks. One look over my shoulder told me that Randy and Enoch were nowhere in sight. Once Enoch had realized what I was doing, it would have been too late to stop me. Nothing was in front of me for several miles except open plains. No place to hide or give the slip to my pursuers. My life depended on staying ahead of them, and I had to hope that Randy's horse was capable of that. When there's nothing else you can do, you lower your head and keep going. Keep moving and hope for the best. It was hours until nightfall. That horse gave it everything. I knew I was going to wind up killing it, and I hated to do that. It must have sensed how desperate I was, and with the huge heart that some animals possess, it set out to save my life, even at the cost of its own. Amazingly, over the next half hour, we actually widened the gap between us and the posse. Then a thinner column of dust separated itself from the big cloud raised by the posse and started drawing closer and closer. I looked over my shoulder and saw what was happening. I realized it wasn't horses' hooves kicking up that dust. It was the tires of an automobile. Muscle and bone, even teamed with a gallant heart, couldn't outrun machinery. Not indefinitely, anyway. I could see the automobile now. Two men were inside it. I figured one of them had to be Sheriff Lester. Chances were, the other man was the one who planned the trap. Much to my dismay, I saw a flash of white up ahead. We'd come to a salt flat. It stretched for a mile or more north and south on both sides of the tracks, and there was no telling how wide it was. I galloped out onto the blindingly white flat. It was a damn shame things hadn't worked out. I rode hard for another mile. The salt flat still stretched ahead of me as far as I could see. I looked back. The automobile was on the salt too, rushing after me. I reined in and turned the horse around, so I was facing my pursuers. The horse stood there, trembling slightly under me, as I took a box of cartridges from Randy's saddlebag and filled the Winchester's magazine.
You did good, old son. I couldn't ask for any more. Now I hope you come out of this all right. But I gotta ask you for one more thing. Let's go!
I drove my heels into the horse's flanks and sent it leaping ahead. As we charged toward the automobile, I brought the rifle to my shoulder and began to fire as fast as I could work the lever. With both of us moving fast like that, we closed the gap between us in a hurry. The fella in the passenger seat leaned out and returned my fire, but I guess the front seat of a bouncing, weaving automobile wasn't any better for accurate shooting than the hurricane deck of a galloping horse. The windshield shattered as one of my bullets struck it. The car skidded hard to its left, sending a shower of salt into the air from the tires. It spun around a couple of times. The passenger jumped out. He must have been jolted around enough during that crazy skid to make him drop his rifle. He clawed a pistol from under his coat, though, and tried to draw a bead on me. I was almost on top of him. I swung the rifle and smacked him in the side of the head with the barrel. He went down. I pulled the horse aside so as not to trample him just in time. Circling back, I covered both men with the rifle. Neither of them moved. The fella I'd just walloped was a stranger to me, although I found out later he was a Pinkerton agent named Simon Barstow. The other man who was slumped forward over the steering wheel was Sheriff Emil Lester, just as I'd figured. I dismounted and hurried over to check on Lester, keeping one eye on the dust cloud from the posse while I was doing it. He seemed to be out cold, and when I pushed him away from the steering wheel, I saw why. He had a big lump on his forehead. I knew he must have hit his head on the wheel while the car was careening around and he knocked himself out. An idea occurred to me. I leaned the Winchester under the side of the automobile, reached in, and got hold of Lester under his arms. I dragged him out and stretched him on the salt. His breathing was all right, and I figured he would be fine when he came to, except for a headache. The other fellow was unconscious too. I just clipped his skull with the rifle barrel, I decided when I probed the bloody lump over his ear. The bone wasn't crushed, so he ought to be all right too, I told myself. Once I checked on him, I went back to Randy's horse. The posse wasn't far off now. I took the saddle off and threw it in the back of the car. A swat on the rump with my hat sent the horse galloping away. The automobile's engine was still running, which was a lucky break for me because I didn't know if I could have gotten it started by myself. I climbed in and put the rifle on the seat beside me. I'd been in these contraptions before. I'd even tried to drive one of them a time or two, so I sort of knew what all the pedals and levers did. I started trying to make it go. It lurched forward and the engine threatened to stall. I held my breath and started running smoother again. The car rolled forward as I pressed my foot down on one of the pedals. Eventually, I got the hang of it and started going faster. I headed north, and as I twisted my neck around to look behind me, I saw the posse in the distance. Now, they would stop to check on Sheriff Lester and his companion, and that would slow them down some. I had a chance to outrun them now, a real chance. As I drove, the excitement started to wear off, and my arm hurt more. When I looked down at my sleeve, I saw that it was bloody all the way down to my wrist. I'd lost quite a bit of blood. I could tell that from the woozy feeling that began to come over me. I told myself as sternly as possible that I couldn't afford to pass out. I tried to force myself to think. Randy's horse was the one he'd ridden in on that night, so it didn't have a fishhook brand on it. Even if the posse found it, and it was possible they wouldn't, they probably wouldn't be able to tell who it belonged to. That was the reason I'd taken the time to remove the saddle and toss it in the car. The horse that had been shot out from under me at the train was one of the mounts that had been ridden by the members of Randy's former gang, and not the one I usually rode into Largo, so there was nothing tying it to the fishhook or to me either. I still had the bandana over the lower half of my face, and my hat was pulled down when I charged toward the automobile. Throw in the glare of the salt flat, and it was doubtful that either man had gotten a real good look at me while the shooting was going on. That left the letter that had lured us into the trap. It was a pretty damning piece of evidence, but I didn't think it actually proved anything. Somebody could have tried to rob that train without knowing there was supposed to be a shipment of gold bullion on it. All that went through my head as I kept driving. I came to the end of the salt flat and continued north. I didn't know how much gasoline the automobile had in it, or how long it would run, but every time I looked back, the dust cloud from the posse was smaller. I was pulling steadily away from them. When I got closer to some hills that lay in my path, I turned west. That took me toward Largo. Dusk settled down, and as the stars came out in the bluish-purple sky above me, I also saw the lights of the settlement twinkling in the distance. Now that it was dark, the posse couldn't trail me, and I became convinced that if I could just make it to Daisy's house, everything would be all right. I felt a keen stab of disappointment when the automobile's engine sputtered and died, and that damn thing shuddered to a stop. Largo was only a few miles away, I estimated. I could walk that far. I climbed out of the car, taking the rifle with me. I didn't like the idea of leaving the saddle behind, but I knew I couldn't carry it too. I settled for slinging the saddlebags over my shoulders and hoped the saddle itself didn't have anything on it that would identify it as belonging to Randy McClellan. I don't remember much about my journey to Largo. I kept my gaze fixed on the lights and pulled one foot in front of the other. Again, and again, and again. It felt like a million miles. But gradually, the twinkling dots of light got bigger and turned into yellow glows from windows. A quarter moon rose behind me, and in the silvery wash of its light, I spotted the church, even though I was still a mile away. After what seemed like an eternity, I found myself at the back of Daisy's house. I knew which window went with her bedroom, so I stumbled over to it.
Jim, my God, is that you?
Daisy, you're so, so beautiful.
Jim, are you drunk?
Drunk on love.
I didn't get any more words out, because the last of my strength deserted me then. I felt myself falling, but that was the last thing I knew. Utter blackness had swallowed me by the time I hit the ground. An unknowable amount of time later, I woke up. Pain flooded through me, followed almost immediately by relief. There's no getting around the fact that if you're hurt, you're still alive. Something soft and cool touched my face.
You're awake, aren't you, Jim?
Opening my eyes seemed to take as much strength as lifting a 50-pound sack of grain would have, but somehow I managed. When the light struck them, I blinked. It really wasn't that bright in the room. It just seemed that way to me at the moment. Actually, the lamp on the table beside the bed was turned down low enough that it left the corners of the room dim and shadowy. Once my eyes adjusted, though, I had no trouble focusing on Daisy as she leaned over me with a concerned expression on her face.
I was afraid you were going to die. You'd lost so much blood.
I reckon I must have been hurt worse than I thought.
You were shot in the arm. You're fortunate the bullet didn't break the bone. At least, I don't think it did.
I thought I'd just been grazed a mite.
Daisy continued wiping my face with the damp cloth she held. It felt about as good as anything I've ever experienced.
You have a fever, Jim. I cleaned and bandaged the wound, but you really need a doctor.
No. No doctor. Where's your father?
He's not here. One of the members of the congregation is gravely ill. Father drove out to his house to sit with him. When I first heard the tapping on the window, I thought you knew somehow that Father was gone and had come to see me with something else in mind. I wasn't expecting to find you injured. What happened?
I got shot while the boys and I were trying to hold up the train. You see, Daisy, I'm Butch Cassidy.
I could tell by the look on her face that she thought I was just raving. But slowly, in fits and starts, because I was so weak, I spilled the whole story to her, starting with the night I'd run into Abner Tillotson. By the time I was finished, she might not have believed me 100%, but at least she didn't think I was completely loco anymore.
None of that really matters right now. What's important is that you rest. You'll feel a lot better once you've had some sleep, I hope.
Maybe. But I gotta get back to the ranch. The sheriff's liable to show up there looking for me. If I ain't there, he'll want to know what's become of me. He's always been a mite suspicious of me.
You don't have to worry about that. If it comes down to it, I'll simply tell Sheriff Lester that you spent the night here. With me.
Oh, good Lord, girl. You can't do that. It'd ruin your reputation. Forever.
Do you honestly think I care about something that unimportant, Jim? My reputation means nothing in comparison to keeping you safe. In the morning, if you're stronger, I'll put you in the buggy and we'll go out to your ranch. The sheriff won't be able to prove that you haven't been there all along.
That's what I'm hoping, Daisy. Thank you. I can't tell you how much I
know. I love you too, Jim.
I had been about to say I couldn't tell her how much I appreciated her help, but I reckon I love you worked just as well. I was able to squeeze one of her hands to let her know I felt the same way. After that, I let myself drift off. The first thing I did the next morning was try to move my arms. I was able to lift the left one, but the right refused to go anywhere. My right arm was heavily bandaged, and Daisy had rigged a sling for it and strapped it down to hold still against my body. It hurt, but really not as much as I expected it to. Daisy appeared at the open door, looking as fresh and pretty as her room. She smiled at me when she saw I was awake. Then she came over and sat down on the edge of the bed beside me.
Your fever broke a little while ago. I was hoping you'd wake up soon. How do you feel this morning, Jim?
Whew, better. My arm don't even hurt too bad. I sure am hungry and thirsty, though.
I'm not surprised. I've hardly been able to get anything down you the past few days.
What do you mean, the past few days? I came here last night.
That was 3 nights ago, Jim.
Oh. What about your dad? He's bound to be back by now.
No. He's been here and gone. Mr. Abercrombie is still sick, but he's hanging on. Father came in, slept for a night, cleaned up, and went back out to the Abercrombie Ranch. He was so tired he never knew you were here. It was quite a dilemma for me. I was worried because you weren't waking up, but at the same time, I didn't want you to wake up and call out while he was here. As it turned out, that didn't happen.
We gotta make sure there's no chance of it happening. I gotta get out of here.
Not until you've had something to eat and drink and I've changed the dressing on your wound. Then maybe we'll see about getting you in the buggy and taking you out to your ranch. Are you sure someone there can take proper care of you?
Yeah, I'll be fine.
Then I'll go get you some breakfast.
That's the best offer I've had in a long time.
If you were stronger, I might make you an even better offer.
Daisy brought back a cup of coffee, a cup of broth, and a biscuit. I wanted to gulp down the drinks, but they were so hot that I had to take it easy and sip them. That biscuit was so light and fluffy, it was like biting into a cloud in heaven. After eating, Daisy changed the bandage on my arm.
The wound looks like it's healing well, Jim. Or should I call you Butch?
Jim's fine. I haven't used that other name for a long time. I'd even start to feel like Butch Cassidy was dead and buried down there in Bolivia.
I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about. I've barely even heard of Butch Cassidy. All I know is that he was some sort of old-time outlaw.
Now you understand how come I keep telling you I'm too old for you. Darling, that's what I am. A relic of the Old West.
You're the most vital man I've ever known. You're hardly a relic. It's true, then, about the train robberies?
It is. I reckon I've broken that thou shalt not steal commandment more than any of the others.
But you said you did it to help young Vince Porter, and then after that to help other people. That doesn't make it really what you'd call...
It's still stealing, and I can understand if you want to turn me over to the law.
I could never do that. Just because something's against the law doesn't mean that it's, well, wrong.
To most folks, that's exactly what it means.
I'm not like most folks. I never have been, and I never will be.
All right, all right. I'm not one to argue morality with anybody. If you're willing to keep quiet about what you know, I appreciate that. For the sake of the other fellas, as much for my own sake.
I can do more than keep quiet.
What do you mean by that?
I think you're strong enough to travel. Let me go see if I can find some of my father's clothes for you to wear.
Daisy got up and left the room. When she came back, she held up a shirt that looked way too big for her pa.
This is the oldest thing Father has.
That shirt's big enough for two of them.
He used to be a much more substantial man than he is now. He went through a bout of illness and nearly died. Since then, he can't seem to regain any weight. He says he's glad it happened, though. He claims it brought him closer to the Lord.
I don't doubt it. Nearly dying has a habit of doing that.
I hope this is big enough that you can put your left arm in the sleeves and then we can just drape the rest of it around you. First, though, we need to get your trousers back on you. There wasn't too much blood on them, and I was able to wash most of it out. I had to burn your shirt, though.
I understand. Just bring me the breeches, and I can put them on myself.
I don't think so. Not as weak as you are, and with only one arm that you can use. I don't mind helping, Jim. I'm not a little girl. Besides, I'm the one who took them off of you.
Yeah, I figured as much. You don't scandalize very easy, do you?
Not at all.
We managed to get clothes on me. It took a while, the shape I was in. And while it was awkward physically, it wasn't too embarrassing, I suppose. When I stood up and tried to walk for the first time in several days, I would have fallen flat on my face if she hadn't been there to hold me up. We struggled to the kitchen, where she had placed a chair beside the back door. Grateful for the chance to rest, I sat down in it while Daisy went to fetch the buggy.
The other night I hid your rifle and handgun in the shed. They're in the back of the buggy now.
We won't need them, but thanks for taking care of them.
We can hope we won't need them, but you never know.
Daisy had gotten to know the area pretty well from the time she'd gone riding with me, so I didn't have to tell her the way to the ranch. She didn't take the easiest, most obvious trail, but rather swung far to the east to make anybody who noticed the buggy leaving Largo think that she wasn't headed for the fish hook. Actually, we were headed toward the old Daltrey place, I realized. Before we got there, she could circle back to the west and go at the fish hook from that direction. Daisy kept the two horses moving along at a steady clip. She didn't let them go too fast because that would jounce me around and maybe hurt my arm.
You know, people all over the county are talking about the train being held up. That Pinkerton detective Barstow has pledged to round up each and every one of you.
Who? That was the first time I'd ever heard Simon Barstow's name. Daisy told me all she had heard about him from the gossip in Farnham's store, as well as the information she'd gleaned from the newspapers. From the sound of it, the story had spread all over the state of Texas in the past few days.
Mr. Barstow is very angry that his trap failed. He wouldn't have sent the letter to Vince to lure you in if he wasn't convinced that you were responsible for the robberies.
He probably got that idea from Sheriff Lester. The sheriff's been suspicious of me right along.
Why didn't they just come out to the ranch and arrest you? Why try to trick you into holding up that train?
Because they don't have any proof we pulled those other jobs. The loot we got from them is cash where they'll never find it. If they were to go into court and say we had to be the robbers because there are nine of us, a jury would never believe it. There might be a dozen ranches around here with nine hands working on them. And we made sure nobody ever got a good enough look at us to identify us.
What are you going to do now? Aren't you worried that if you keep going like you are, sooner or later you'll make a mistake and get caught?
Yeah, we'll lay low for a while. I'll have to talk it over with the boys and see if they want to quit entirely after what happened. If they do, I won't try to talk them out of it. It's always been their decision.
I can understand why you'd want to put all that behind you. But if you were to stop now, it would be almost like you allowed that awful man Barstow to beat you.
Why, Miss Hatfield? It almost sounds like you're encouraging me to go out and hold up another train.
No, not at all. I just think that in the end, everyone has to be true to himself or herself. Knowing you has made me see some things differently, Jim.
I would have liked to ask her what she meant by that, but I didn't get a chance. We were passing a little canyon that cut through a ridge to our left, and as we did, a rider spurred out of it and lunged toward us. He had a rifle in his hands. The shot he fired over our heads made the buggy horses shy and dance around skittishly. Daisy had to saw at the reins for a minute and bring them under control and keep them from running away. As the buggy came to an abrupt halt, the rider stopped about 20 feet away and leveled his rifle at us. I knew him right away. Simon Barstow had the drop on us.
Mr. Jim Strickland, I believe.
What if I am? Why don't you put that gun down? You don't need it.
I think I'd rather not take that chance. You have a habit of slipping away from justice, Strickland. Almost like some of those old-time bandits.
Sir, you don't know who...
You don't know what you're talking about.
Why have you stopped us, sir? Are you gonna rob us?
Hardly. I'm not an outlaw. My name is Simon Barstow. I work for the Pinkerton Detective Agency. Your companion there is the lawbreaker.
You're mistaken. Mr. Strickland is a well-respected cattleman. You can ask anyone in the area about him. They'll tell you what a fine man he is.
And people who didn't know any better said that Jesse James was a fine man, too. What are you doing here, Strickland? The men at your ranch, the rest of your gang, swore that you had gone to San Antonio to negotiate a deal to buy more cattle.
How do you know I didn't?
You can't be in San Antonio and riding along with Miss Hatfield in a buggy at the same time, now can you? Not only that, you appear to have a wounded arm. Is that a bullet hole in it, perhaps?
My horse threw me. My shoulder's wrenched from the fall, and I think I might have torn a muscle. That's why my arm's all wrapped up.
Of course it is.
I walked on into Largo since my horse ran off, and Miss Hatfield was kind enough to offer to drive me back to the ranch.
From what I hear, that's not the only thing Miss Hatfield has been kind enough to do for you. The two of you have quite the romance going on. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Strickland. You're not only a train robber, you've robbed the cradle as well.
You keep a civil tongue in your head. You clearly don't know what you're talking about.
All right, that's enough. Leave Miss Hatfield out of this. She never knew the truth about me until today. When I showed up wounded at her house, I forced her to take care of me. Just like I'm forcing her to drive me to the ranch. That's right. You got me, mister. I'll confess to all of it in court, including the way I kidnapped Miss Hatfield. Once she found out what I've really been doing, she didn't want anything more to do with me.
I don't believe you. But if you're willing to confess to your crimes, and to implicate your accomplices in the process, I suppose we can leave out any mention of your illicit relationship with Miss Hatfield.
You got a deal. Daisy opened her mouth to say something, probably to argue, but I drowned her out again. Go ahead, take me on back to the county seat. Turn the damn buggy around, woman.
Hold it. We're not going back to the county seat yet. Drive on, Miss Hatfield. There's the remains of an old shack up ahead a ways. That's where we're going.
Barstow jerked the rifle barrel at Daisy and forced her to get the buggy moving again. He rode alongside us and drew a pistol with his right hand while using his left to slide the rifle back into its scabbard. He could cover us easier with the handgun from that position.
We're going to rendezvous with Sheriff Lester. He's out here searching for you too, Strickland. We knew you'd try to make it back to your ranch sooner or later from wherever you were holed up. I was convinced that Miss Hatfield was hiding you and wanted to break in there and search the place, but the sheriff refused. You seem to feel that since Miss Hatfield is the daughter of a minister, she deserved the benefit of the doubt. We've been ranging back and forth between Largo and the Fishhook. You really should have continued to lay low. I might have gotten tired of searching and given up, eventually. About the same time that hell freezes over.
What made you come after us in the first place?
Sheriff Lester put me on your trail. All he had were vague, unfounded suspicions, though. I launched a thorough investigation and discovered that the first holdup took place after the accidental death of a railroad employee whose son works for you. That might have given you a grudge against the railroad. I interviewed everyone I could find who witnessed the robberies, and although everyone told the stories slightly differently, I determined that the average number of participants in the crime seemed to be 9. That was the exact number of you and your crew, including the 3 Mexicans who work for you part-time.
You couldn't find any other spreads that have 9 hands?
None that had a connection to the railroad. With all that to go on, it didn't take long to find out that in the past few months, you've been handing out quite a bit of money to what could be considered worthy causes and individuals. Did you have some idea that such charity made it all right to steal from the railroad, Strickland? I knew you were the ones I was after, but I thought if I could catch you in the act, it would tie everything up neatly. So I set that trap and baited it with a letter supposedly from John Hamilton.
What did you do? Browbeat a dying man into helping you? Wouldn't put it past you.
Neither would I, but that wasn't necessary. You see, early in my career, I handled several forgery cases, and I learned all the tricks of the trade employed by such criminals. I'm a pretty good forger, if I do say so myself. All I needed was a sample of Hamilton's handwriting, and it wasn't difficult to get that. Any inconsistencies would be put down to the fact that everyone would think he wrote the letter on his deathbed.
That tied it all up, as far as I could see. Nice and neat, just like he'd said. And we were inside of what was left of the Daughtry shack by now. It had decayed and fallen in even more. In another year or two, nobody would be able to tell that folks had ever even lived here. Barstow glanced up at the sun.
Sheriff Lester is supposed to meet me here at midday. We'll wait for him and go back to the county seat together.
You want to show off how smart you are, right?
Smart enough to catch you.
Suddenly, Daisy came up halfway off the seat.
Oh, my head, it's spinning. I'm going to...
Daisy fell forward, but as she landed on the floorboard, she slapped the reins hard against the rumps of both horses. They lunged ahead, throwing Daisy and me both backward. Pretending to faint like that had drawn Barstow's eyes to her, just like she thought it would. And that pulled his gun out of line. When he tried to jerk it back toward me and fire, the bullet tore through the back of the buggy's canopy instead. I twisted on the seat and reached behind it with my left hand, searching for the coiled shell belt and holstered Remington that Daisy had put back there before we left Largo. Barstow kicked his horse into a gallop and came after us, firing his pistol.
Stay down!
I continued fumbling for the gun. Daisy was lying on the floorboard, bumping against my legs as she slashed at the team and kept them running. More of Barstow's bullets tore through the canopy and whizzed around my head. My hand closed around the Remington's ivory grips as the ridge against which the Daughtry shack was built loomed up in front of us. Daisy had to swing the buggy to the side to keep from crashing into it. As I yanked the revolver from its holster, I felt the buggy tip. I went over and crashed to the ground in front of the shack. I was thrown out when the buggy turned over. I didn't know what had happened to Daisy. Momentum rolled me over a couple times before I stopped. Somehow I managed to hang on to the gun in my left hand. Dust roiled around me as I lifted my head.
Daisy!
I couldn't see her, and I was desperate to know what had happened to her.
You son of a bitch! You won't get away from me again!
Jim!
Barstow loomed out of the dust on his feet now instead of the saddle, gun in his outthrust hand. A light-colored shape darted in between us from the side.
Mr. Barstow! Don't!
Barstow pulled the trigger.
Daisy!
I fired again and again until the hammer fell on an empty chamber, all five rounds tearing through Simon Barstow's body. He flopped to the ground, dead as a man could be.
Daisy! Daisy!
By the time he landed, I had forgotten all about him. I'd already dropped my empty gun and started crawling toward Daisy, who lay sprawled a few feet away. She rolled over and looked at me. Her eyes were open. I didn't see any blood on her dress. She came up to her knees at the same time I did.
Oh, Jim.
And threw her arms around me. My good arm went around her and held her tightly to me.
I'm all right, Jim. I just tripped and fell while I was trying to shield you. I'm not hurt.
Don't you ever scare me like that again, Daisy Hatfield. Daisy clung to me. After a moment, she pulled back.
What about you? Are you hurt?
Oh, reckon my arm's bleeding again. But I'll live. Damn right I would, I thought, as Daisy hugged me some more. Sheriff Lester rode up about 15 minutes after the shootout with Barstow. That gave Daisy and me time to get ready for him. We trampled all over the place, making sure that the tracks didn't tell any comprehensible story. I was sitting on the ground, leaning against the overturned buggy. Daisy sat next to me, re-bandaging my bloody, apparently freshly wounded arm.
It was terrible. That awful man was hiding in that tumble-down shack. He came out and started shooting at us with no warning as soon as we drove up. Mr. Strickland was wounded right away. The man probably would have killed us if Mr. Barstow hadn't returned his fire and driven him off. Unfortunately, poor Mr. Barstow was mortally wounded in the exchange of shots.
The sheriff just looked at Barstow's bullet-riddled body.
Yeah, mortally wounded and then some, I'd say. He was shot by some fellow who was hiding in the shack?
That's right, Sheriff. I figure he must have been that train robber Barstow told us he was looking for. When I mentioned this old shack to him, he said this was just the sort of place where an owl hoot on the run might hold up. So, I offered to show him where it was.
What happened to this outlaw?
I believe he was wounded. With everything that was going on, I didn't really see what happened to him. He must have run off.
Maybe he had a horse hidden in the brush. Take a look around, Sheriff. You might be able to pick up his trail. For a long time, Lester didn't say anything. He stood there looking at us. And after a while, he lifted a hand and rubbed his chin as he frowned and thought.
I reckon that'd be a waste of time. Whoever this fellow was, he's long gone by now. Too bad about Barstow. I got to know him a little the past few days. Never saw anybody who hated outlaws more than he did. It struck me that when he was after somebody he considered a lawbreaker, he might gun down anybody who got in his way, male or female, no matter who they were.
I only just met him today, so I couldn't really say, Sheriff. But from what I saw of him, I think that's exactly what he might have done.
So, you were on your way back to the Fish Hook from a business trip in San Antonio?
Well, that's right. Miss Hatfield was giving me a ride. That's where we were going when we ran into that Barstow fella.
Well, what happened to your horse?
Well, you see, he threw me and ran off when I was almost back to Largo. Got spooked by a rattlesnake coiled up under a mesquite. But I was able to hoof it into town and prevail upon Miss Hatfield here to help me out.
Uh-huh.
Lester turned his head, peered off into the distance, and chewed his mustache. I could tell his thoughts were eating him up inside. He didn't believe our story for a second. But he couldn't prove we were lying. Not convincingly enough to take it to court, anyway. At any rate, Lester had just about openly admitted that Barstow was a sorry bastard who would shoot a woman if she got in his way. Given that, you might say that Barstow had gotten what was coming to him. I could read the decision on Lester's face as he made up his mind.
You're wounded, Strickland. We'd better get you back to town.
We're a lot closer to the fishhook, Sheriff. Fellas there can take care of me. If you'll just dab a rope on this buggy and use your horse to set it upright again.
Fine. I'll see to it that you get home. Then I'll come back here for Barstow's body. His bosses won't be happy that he's dead. They're liable to send even more men after those train robbers, especially after the owners of the railroad get through yelling.
You could be right, Sheriff.
Daisy helped me to my feet.
I think they're gonna have a long chase for nothing, though. My hunch is that those varmints have lit a shuck out of this part of the country. You might not ever see them again.
Normally, I wouldn't say this about a bunch of no-good outlaws, but there's a part of me that hopes you're right about that, Strickland.
A little while later, as we were rolling along in the buggy while Lester rode ahead of us, Daisy leaned over to me.
Were you telling the truth back there, Jim, when you said that to the sheriff about the train robbers never coming back?
If they've got any sense, that'd be the smartest thing for them to do.
In a way, that would be a shame. I was thinking that the real problem is the gang needs 10 members instead of 9.
And just where would that 10th desperado come from?
Daisy looked over at me and her smile widened. I was gonna tell her she was loco, too. But I knew it wouldn't do any good. Daisy Hatfield had a mind of her own. I could see the ranch up ahead now. Somebody must have noticed us coming, because several of the fellas were riding out to meet us. Enoch lifted a hand and waved. Scar bounded alongside the old gunwolf's horse.
Just think about it, Jim. That's all I'm asking.
I will.
I promised. But I already knew what my decision would be. My train robbing days were over, and Butch Cassidy was finally dead.
But that's not true, is it? You weren't through robbing trains, were you? Or banks, either.
This here pop ran dry a long time ago.
I'll get you another one.
Hold on, son. No need to do that. I'm dry, too. I'm done talked out.
You can't stop there. You've admitted that you're Butch Cassidy.
Now wait just a doggone minute. I never did no such thing.
But Jim told his friends that he was Butch Cassidy. He even told Miss Hatfield.
Maybe he did. That don't make it true. He could have just been making up a whopper of a lie to get folks to go along with what he wanted them to do.
This is ridiculous. First, you admit that you used to go by the name Jim Strickland, and then you say that Strickland was really Butch Cassidy, but now you're denying the whole thing.
I never said such, and I can't be held to account for anything old Jim might have said to anybody else, now can I? It's just a story, son. Maybe some of it's true, maybe all of it's true. After all this time, what does it really matter?
Because I want to find out what happened. There were other things in my grandfather's papers. Notes about Pancho Villa and a bank in Mexico, and something about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson. I want to know about that, and all the other things he hinted about. And what about Daisy? I don't recall seeing anything about her. If she was so important in Jim Strickland's life, why is there no mention of her in my grandfather's papers?
That's a good question. Thing of it is, I don't have an answer for you. Not today, anyway.
Does that mean you might be willing to talk to me again?
Hear those old bones popping and creaking when I get up?
That's what living too long will do for you. Time you get to be my age, all you got left is memories and aching joints.
You didn't answer my question. Will you talk to me again and tell me the rest of it?
I guess you'll just have to come back and find out. I do like a dramatic moment.
Butch Cassidy, The Lost Years, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2013, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Tim Gatman, Stephen Carpenter, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, David Harris, James Konacek, Michael John Casey, Evan Casey, Joe Brack, Terrence Aselford, Patrick Busink, Tim Pabone, David Jordan, Scott McCormick, Nanette Savard, Bradley Smith, Tim Carlin, Christopher Grayville, Gabriella Fernandez Coffey, Tim Lynch, and Barbara Pinolini. Directed by Tim Gatman. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. The Butch Cassidy theme was composed by Thomas Hogan. Book adapted by Doug Krenzlin. If you enjoyed Butch Cassidy, The Lost Years, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's other westerns, as well as Elmer Kelton's Texas Ranger series. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Graphic Audio presents Charles G. West's Thunder over Lolo Pass.
My goodness, what's she doing out here by herself?
Are you Mr. McCloud?
I am, miss.
They told me in Stevensville that you would be the man to see. They said that nobody in the valley knew the Bitterroot Mountains as well as Donovan McCloud and his three sons.
So why were you looking for me?
I need help in finding someone.
Miss, it ain't none of my business, but it sure don't seem smart for a woman like yourself to be riding down here without some protection.
I reckon you were right in looking for help. Because if you don't know those mountains, a man would be mighty hard to find. Especially if he didn't necessarily want to be found.
Can you take me to his camp?
Yes, ma'am. I can find it again.
That part of the Bitterroots is some of the roughest country you're likely to find anywhere. It's hardly a place most ladies would care to travel.
I'm not most ladies.
Charles G. West's Thunder over Lolo Pass.
Available now in graphic audio.
Blood Valley 6. Support your local deputy.
My deputy, Rusty Irons, was as itchy as a man ever gets. Rusty was waiting for his mail-order brides. That's right, brides. Siamese twins, joined at the hip from the Ukraine.
Whoa! We got held up, man!
Quill, tell me, what happened and what got took?
Nothing got took, just the twins.
Were they hostages? Would they be returned for a reward?
Nope. No sign of it.
Who'd want female Siamese twins?
We got a medicine show in town. Professor Zoroaster Zimmer is pushing his elixir. And you know what that means. Nothing safe around here.
We got trouble. George Waller says he's been robbed.
Burgled or robbed?
He says the store's been locked tight at night. But someone's sneaking stuff out when no one's looking. He says arrest all these medicine people.
Sheriff, I'm Hatfield McCoy. This is my wife, Judith. We're members of the Children's Aid Society. Are you familiar with it? The society was formed back east to help the thousands of orphans in the big cities, especially New York, children who have lost their parents or are simply running free, unsupervised. It is the society's mission to place these children on Western ranches, where they'll become valuable additions to the homes and businesses that adopt them.
And these little people, they got no say in it? Not even if they fear and dread some new parent?
They're minors, sir, under adult supervision. We are their legal guardians.
trouble, Sheriff. Them two hooligans, they got King and Queen captive and are holding out for 10 grand.
Captive? 10 grand?
The orphans, little bastards, they worked this out. There's guns all over the ranch and they collected a bunch. Caught King Bragg and his sister at dawn and are holding them in the big house. Say they want 10 grand and a getaway buggy, and if they don't get the dough, they'll kill King and Queen.
Big Finn, how are you gonna get out of there?
10 grand in small bills, Sheriff, by sundown. Plus that buggy and fast saddle horses, and you get to be our insurance.
There isn't that much cash in the bank, boy.
That's the deal, Sheriff. Bring the dollars or Queen's gonna croak.
Hey, Sheriff, why don't you just let them kill each other?
Help me, Mr. Mayor. We got people getting killed in there. All right, I'm taking you all in.
What are you charging them with?
Well, let's see. Disturbing the peace, assault and battery, destroying the saloon. I need to look that up. You name it, I'll include it.
The Wild West scoundrels are herewith fined $20 or 2 weeks in our iron cages. Their choice. If they choose to pay, they must leave town before sundown. Now then, the locals who confess to crimes beyond number, crimes exceeding the stars in heaven, must endure a harsher fate. I herewith sentence them all to hang by the neck until dead, 1 week from today.
Sheriff, where's my money? What are you going to do?
Now cut it out. I'm a judge here. I'm telling you to quiet down. Now listen to me.
Hang these bastards. String them up.
Alvin, stop this. Before something happens, you'll regret.
Whoa! Kill him!
Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or go to www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, or want the complete series now, check out our long-haul MP3 series sets, conveniently shipped to you on a USB flash drive. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.